Take it away.
Hi, everybody. My name is Larsine. I'm a very grateful member of Al-Anon.
Hi, Larsine.
And I want to thank Vanessa for the invitation to get to be here with you guys today. And I want to thank Nancy for being such a wonderful hostess. And she has been of a remarkable service. I mean, she's been in touch with me and very kind to me. And it's always amazing to me how you get off a plane and you walk into a car, you know, you get in a car. My mom is always like, you don't know who these people are and you're going to get in their car. You know, so it's just like, yes, I am. And a couple of times I've actually gotten in the wrong car. Somebody said it was a blue something. I hopped in. The guy's just looking at me with big giant eyes like, who the heck are you? Just part of the deal here. But I thank you, Nancy. And I thank you, Vanessa, for the invitation to be here. And I want to thank all the speakers this weekend. You guys have been absolutely phenomenal. It's just been my absolute pleasure to get to be in your presence. And you know, and I'm going to just start out right away to let you guys know I'm not in my best place. I'm very, very torn up. My husband passed away 5 months ago, and it's been a really, really, really difficult time for me. And I'm not a crier, which is making it all the more harder. And I even Googled how much you can cry in a day. You know, apparently it's a lot. Or at least I'm breaking a record. I don't know. And I don't care. It's all okay. You know, but I am not 100% myself, and I don't know when I'm going to be, and that's okay too. I just miss him a lot, you know, and the day he died, my heart just shattered, and it still is. But you know, when you're in this program as long as I am, and you have the Friends in Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon as I have, and you have a connection with a higher power as I have, you know, that's what's holding my heart together. It's like Gorilla Glue or something. It's just, you know, that's a power that I think the speakers have been talking about all weekend, is that you can tap into, that will see you through even the toughest times. And even though my heart is shattered, I'm here to tell you it is intact. And so I'm just finding a new path, you know, and I'm finding my way to a new freedom and a new happiness. I just don't know the way yet. But I hear your voices on it, and they're calling me, and I'm doing my best to get there. But I don't want this to be a sad thing, because life isn't sad. When I got here, I thought life really sucked, and that it was a rigged deal and all of that. But you know, again, how I've been affected by the disease of alcoholism, and I'm not the person that drinks here. I'm the oldest of four kids. My dad was a master sergeant in the Army, so that means you know, like I've always had automatic some kind of rank, okay? I'm just like, so if I'm the oldest, I'm automatically the corporal. You know, he's the sergeant, I'm the corporal. My husband jokes that I came out of the womb carrying a clipboard and wearing an armband. And he's not too far off the mark. You know, when I was in school, I was always room monitor, cafeteria monitor, playground monitor. And why? Because if anybody did anything wrong, I would report them. And it's a gift I still have to this day. A gift is a gift. You know, God gives you gifts, and that's just the way that it goes. And I don't know why. It just is. I've just always been aware of what you're doing. And it's not even so much that I want to report you. I really want to help you more. But sometimes I have to report you to get you the help you need. But now it's different for me. I've been in Al-Anon a long time. I still report people, but now I just report your butts to God. You know, I just say, hey, Joe Blow over here, somebody's got to keep an eye on this guy. He's in big, big trouble. And it still works for me to this day. But, you know, and we say reporting today. What I know I'm doing is I'm praying. You know, I'm not praying, you know, that anything specific happen anymore. I just pray that God watch over you and give you the help that you need and that you're able to receive it. And again, how grateful I am for that. But anyway, my dad was a master sergeant in the Army. I'm the oldest of four kids, and I grew up with a lot of discipline. The Army's all about the discipline. You know, we grew up, we had little Army beds. We had Army blankets on our beds. We had footlockers at the end of our bed. You know, I mean, I would do room inspection 4 and 5 years old. My dad would pop a quarter on that bed, you know, because I know how to make a bed. You know, you can't be in the military and not know how to do that. And I loved it. I loved every bit of it. I remember standing there saluting the Sarge. You know, he'd salute me and all this stuff. And I mean, you know, and I have no idea, you know, about all this craziness that goes on, because my dad's an alcoholic. I don't know that. It's not like you're born and you get a brochure that says, hey, your dad's an alcoholic. This will explain a lot of the crazy crap that's going on in your life. I didn't. It's just the stuff that was going on in my life. And when you're living in that craziness, a lot of crazy things happen. A lot of crazy things happen. My dad loved to take me to the barracks all the time. And he would dress down these young soldiers that are under his care to show them how his five-year-old daughter could make a better bed. And I was proud of that, you know, because I didn't know any different. You know, I didn't know I was contributing to the humiliation of somebody else. You know, again, when you don't know, you don't know. And so somewhere in all that, it just became like, I always have to be number one. I always have to be the best. I always have to excel at all of this. It's very important that I stay ahead of you no matter who you are. You know, and again, how I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism, and I don't even know it. And there's a lot of good stuff in there. There is a lot of good stuff in there. But when it's affected by the disease of alcoholism, all the best things in the world that you learn can just turn into, you know, become absolutely character defects, as has been shared, you know, this weekend. You know, I'm just going to kind of cut to the chase here with my dad. You know, when I was new in Al-Anon, I went to lots of open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I cannot recommend that enough, especially if you're new in Al-Anon. It says in our Al-Anon literature that we should learn all we can about the disease of alcoholism. And I know no better place to learn that than in open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember being at one of those very first AA meetings, and the AA speaker that night, he talked about alcoholism, the family disease. That was his whole talk, and he described alcoholism, the family disease, as like having a rhinoceros in your living room, but everybody pretends it's a coffee table. And boy, if I can describe the house that I grew up in the 50s and the 60s, that's just because you didn't talk about it. It wasn't like on, you know, what Hollywood Squares or whatever shows they have that just show who the next alcoholic is, and that, you know, you just didn't talk about it. You never spoke about anything that went on in your house, period. It was just the way that it was. You know, and the way that I describe it in the house that I grew up in is we'd all be at the dinner table, and my mom, you know, would know that my dad was going to explode because he exploded every night, so it wasn't a hard guess. But, you know, but she would still try and do everything in her power to prevent that from happening. So we'd be at the dinner table, and when your mom is looking at you and she's doing all of this, you know, I mean, that is not, you know, that's not an epileptic fit. That's red alert at the alcoholic dinner table. Don't talk, don't move. You know, don't do anything to upset your dad. You know, but of course you have four kids, and it wouldn't matter. You could clink a glass, and my dad would go ballistic, dinner would go flying, everybody'd get a beating, everybody's got to go to bed, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, my mom, the kids, the dog, it's how it goes down in our house. And I remember the next morning creeping down the hallway to go in the kitchen to have breakfast before I went to school. And there'd be my dad drinking his breakfast beer. And no one ever one time said, gee whiz, Dad, what was that about last night? Gee whiz, how come you had to hit everybody? How come you had to break everything? You know, because in our house, every single day, the rhinoceros just went back to being a coffee table again. And then what I consider to be, you know, the Al-Anon, you know, motto or something is, you hope today will be different. Even though you have no reason to think that it will be, that's the hope that we still have. I think every single person has. And maybe that's that God consciousness in you that something's going to happen that's going to make this be a better situation. You know, and in our case, it was never a better situation. It just got progressively worse and progressively worse and progressively worse. And my dad ended up dying. He died when he was 55 years old. He died the death that they talk about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, Total Insanity and Death. I can't even tell you the last words my dad said to me because they were so vile and so vulgar. I wouldn't even repeat them. You know, and I always say the last words my dad said, and in reality, what I know today is those were just the last words my dad's alcoholism said before it took the life of yet just one more person. And before it took the life of one more person, it did its very best to spit out the ugliest stuff it could, because that's the family disease of alcoholism. It doesn't want to leave you with a tearful thing or anything else like that. It just wants to keep that hate and that anger and that frustration just going on and on and on. And I'll tell you, when the doctors came out and told me and my sisters that my dad had passed away, I'd like to tell you we were sad. We were not. My sisters and I were like, ding dong, the witch is dead, da da da. And I don't tell you the story because I'm proud of it. I tell you the story because this is how my family is affected by the disease of alcoholism. That you'd rather see somebody dead than live in that reign of terror just one more day. Whatever, you know. And at this point, I want you to know I've been in Al-Anon. My dad died October of 81. I started coming to Al-Anon in June of 81. So June to October, I'd only been coming but a few months. I wasn't anywhere close to loving, forgiving, understanding, none of that stuff. I was still very much, you know, very much a newcomer, very, very, very still confused. But I was coming to the meetings. I had a sponsor. I was working the steps to the best of my ability. And I wanted what you had. And I've never really liked Al-Anon. Even today, sometimes I get mad. But But it's just really just because I know what I'm hearing here is the truth. You know, it's just, and I don't want to hear it because I want to be right. My whole life has been about being right. And when you're living in the active disease of alcoholism, it's like it's always telling you you're wrong. You know, when these things would happen in our house and we would question them, we would be like, how dare you question this? So it's just, you know, it's always this fight about, is this a wrong thing or is this a good thing? Is this my fault or is it, you know, what's, you know, and it's just, and that's the whole thing I think about the family disease of alcoholism is it keeps everybody in so much confusion. You just don't understand. You know, I love in our literature how it says how we become sick too. And we become sick too without realizing it because how we are affected by the disease. Because there's no logic and we keep trying to apply logic to an illogical situation. And, you know, and so it, you know, it progressed and progressed. And like I say, I'm coming to the meetings. And even though I didn't like coming to the meetings, I kept trying to talk myself out of the meetings. The only explanation I can give you is why I kept coming back to Al-Anon ever since that very first meeting, you know, when I started coming, is because I think anybody in AA or in Al-Anon knows when they're sitting in a room, and I think you know when you're hearing the truth. You might not want to hear it. You might not want to like it. You might want to call it something else. But I think inside you have that feeling there's something here that's telling me the truth and I know it. You know, and that's my only explanation for exactly why I kept coming back. But I was coming and I was hearing the truth and I wanted things to change in my life. And I really thought that the day that my dad died that the reign of terror was over in our house and the alcoholic was dead, tra-la-la-la-la, off we go skipping down the lane here. You know, but all that happened that day that I can tell you from my experience and that of my sisters is the only thing that happened that day is the alcoholic died. But the family disease of alcoholism was alive and well in me and my sisters and how we had been affected by the disease. And I know this because, you know, a little bit later on, you know, I'd be somewhere and, boy, if anybody would get a tone and talk to me in the tone my dad would talk to me in, boy, the hair on the back of my neck goes up and I am so angry and so pissed off. And I don't know how you guys are here, you know, but for me, when I'm angry and pissed off, I like to take that home and share it with my husband and my children and the people that I love and care about the most, because isn't that the family disease of alcoholism? And if you can get the neighbors involved, extra points for you. You know, I mean, it's just like, let's just suck in as many people in this drama as we possibly can. And I'm coming to the meetings, and I don't want to be doing that. I'm yelling at my kids. I'm still physically hitting my children, you know, and I don't want to be doing this stuff, and I don't understand why I'm coming and why I'm still having these reactions. And I remember going to my first sponsor, Jeannie, and Jeannie was my first sponsor for the first 10 years I was in the program until she passed away. And she was a little tiny Dutch lady. You could hardly understand a bloody word she said until you asked her to be your sponsor, and then all of a sudden everything's crystal clear. I don't know what that is. That's a God thing, but... But I remember going to her and telling her, you know, what am I doing wrong? I'm doing everything you tell me to do. I'm going to meetings. I'm being of service. I'm working the steps. I'm blah, 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 blah. And I'm still having these reactions. I'm still so angry. And, you know, and Al-Anon doesn't work because that's always my battle. It doesn't work. You guys are suckering me in one more time. And I remember her saying to me, you know, Larsine, because you constantly want to look at the problem. And Al-Anon isn't about the problem. You know, Al-Anon's about the solution. And she says, and I'm going to give you an assignment, and you're not going to like it. And she always prefaced it with, and you're not going to like it. Because like I said, I never like one weeny thing they've ever told me to do in Al-Anon, okay? They just, you know, you come in here with big, big problems, and you know what they say to you? Easy does it. Like, go and let God. Like, well, duh. You know, like, you're kidding me, right, people? You know, and then in my sick mind, what I'm thinking is, my problems are so huge, I'm blowing you guys out of the water. You don't even know what to say. You're just reading the crap on the walls, because I'm just like, my problems are so, you know, beyond any kind of help. And again, you know, the ego just isn't reserved for the alcoholic, I am here to tell you. And, you know, and really what I've come to find out, you know, is... growing up in the family disease of alcoholism to me is like just, what it's done is it's given me this giant magnifying glass because the disease of alcoholism is based on fear. And what this magnifying glass does and what happened to me is just when anything happens, no matter how minor it is, right away the magnifying glass goes out and I blow it up into some huge thing. I mean, I can, you know, get a flat tire and 10 seconds later in my brain, everybody's dead and it's all my fault. I mean, that's just where my mind will go with it. And again, and that's because I grew up in a house where very minor things would happen, and they would blow up into this huge, violent, crazy situation. You know, so I'm just like always on constant, like, oh, what am I going to do to stop, you know, this and this and this? And I would call my sponsor and be all hysterical, and she would say, what happened? And then I would go, not only I would tell her what I'm so afraid is going to happen, and she goes, no, let's back up. What's really happened? What got you upset in the first place? I got a flat tire, you know. And then we would go back, okay, Lynn, let's just focus on the truth, not what you think is going to happen after X and Y and Z. What's going on right now? And then there's two solutions. There's either something for you to do or there's nothing for you to do. And if there's something for you to do, you guys are not going to believe this, but guess what it is? It's easy does it, let go and let God, one day at a time. They're absolutely telling you the positive truth here. Save yourself 42 years. I'm just telling you, those are the answers, you know. But how we are affected by the disease of alcoholism doesn't want us to think that there's a simple thing. There's a very, very simple answer here. But we want to complicate the crap out of it, because when you complicate the crap out of stuff, there is no solution. There's just the fear and what's going to happen and all the scary stuff that goes along with that. And when you're living in this scary spot, it's hard to find God in all of that, because God lives in the light. God lives in the truth and not in the lies. So anyway, so she said, I'm going to give you this assignment, and I'm not going to like it. And this assignment was, I was supposed to think up a good thing my dad has done for me. And I'm pretty cocky most of the time, and I was very cocky with her that day, and I was just like, you are out of your flipping mind, lady. You want me to think of a good thing my dad has done for me when my first remembrance on the face of this planet is fear? Fear at my father's hands. That's my first memory of being alive. And you want me, and when I get the head bobbing thing, boy, I'm off, okay? And when you want me, you know, to come up with a good thing he has done for me, and I remember her just stopping, just, Larsine, I'm not making you do anything. All I've ever asked you to do is to be willing. Just to be willing to think about a different way of doing something. Think about it. See if you're willing. And I remember when I was new in Al-Anon, I went to a meeting and I heard somebody share, you know, if you're not willing to do anything different, how can you possibly expect anything to be different? And for whatever reason, that has made sense to me, because it makes sense. And I've always been willing. Mind you, I'm only this much willing, because that's how pig-headed I am. But I believe this program to be so powerful, you only need this much willingness, but you need some. You have to have some willingness. And so I've always been this much willing. And so I don't know how long it took, a week or 2 weeks, and I remembered that my dad taught me how to drive. And if you're going to live in Southern California and marry an alcoholic of your own and track that sucker down, it's just a skill you got to have. And I'm talking about tracking alcoholics down, no cell phones, no GPS. We didn't have any of that stuff, nothing. You know, you just had a car and your desire to find someone who didn't want to be found. I mean, it's just... I still don't even understand what that was all about. But again, the absolute insanity of the disease of alcoholism. So I remember going to Jeannie thinking she wouldn't be happy with this answer, you know, and remember walking up to her at the meeting going, I thought I've got a good thing my dad has done. And Jeannie was a clapper, which irritated the crap out of me, because every time I did anything good, she'd be like, and when I, most of the time, she would just go, jeez, just look down and shake her head. But this time I got a clap, you know, and then again, I didn't think she'd be happy with the answer, but I said, you know, he taught me how to drive. And she was ecstatic. You think I'd come up with a cure for cancer, just as happy as she was about it. But in my defense, it was my rookie year in Al-Anon. I didn't know once your sponsor gave you an assignment, there would be part two. Okay? And part two is the action. Part two is the different thing you're going to do to have your life be a little bit different. And then she said to me, Larsine, now whenever you think about, you know, some humiliation, some embarrassment, you know, some beating you took from your dad, whatever it is that makes you all angry, and it, she says, I just want you to replace that negative thought with this positive one, that he taught you how to drive. He goes, and then I want you to think about your dad. You know, he's 55 years old when he died. You know, he died, not only did he die from the disease of alcoholism, he died with all of his children being grateful he was dead. You have kids. You think your dad wanted that to happen to him? Would you want that to happen to you? And the thought never once occurred to me. Not one time did it occur to me. And then the second thing she said to me, she said, did you ever think that maybe, just maybe, your dad loved you as much as his alcoholism would allow him to? And can you ask anyone to love you more than they're capable of doing? And again, those are thoughts that would never, ever cross my mind. They don't when you're the victim. They don't when you're the innocent person. You know, and I don't mean to share with you, you know, that I grew up with this hellacious dad who beat us, who made us feel bad about being girls, you know, who was abusive in so many ways. And then I came to Al-Anon and I did this weenie assignment. Now it's rainbows and butterflies out my butt. You know, that is not what happened to me at all. You know, what happened to me that day, that continues to happen to me day after day after day in this program, is that I got the gift of forgiveness. And I don't think there's anything much more powerful than that. You know, it says in our Al-Anon literature that forgiveness is no favor. And then the second line, which blew my mind, it says, we do it for nobody but ourselves. Because, see, I thought if I was forgave my dad, I was letting him off the hook. And I wasn't going to do it because it wasn't right. And Al-Anon has never told me that any of that stuff was right. All I've got to learn here is that my dad suffered from the disease of alcoholism, and this is the stuff that goes on in alcoholic homes. And as long as I want to keep punishing my dad, and as long as I want to keep blaming my dad, you know, then there is no hope for me. You know, but when I was able to forgive my dad, that I was able, I mean, my whole life opened up. And not only did my life get better, my husband's life got better, my children's lives got better, my neighbor's lives got better. Just the way it works. Because that's the way love is. It's like a freaking tidal wave that just goes out there, you know. And just to be clear, you know, when my dad died, you know, my dad was a career soldier, and he was he served in World War II. He was a Korean veteran. He was a Purple Heart recipient. He was a very good soldier, and just not such a great dad, but. Anyway, my mom had long since divorced him, and I'm the oldest, so they bring me his ashes and the flag and all this stuff over to my house. I happened to be home alone that day, and the soldiers left, and here I got my dad's ashes, so I took him downstairs, and behind my garage was my laundry room, so I sat him behind the washing machine, and I said, you sit here and you think about what you did, and my dad sat there for a long time, let me tell you. Sponsor approved, too, boy, because it's a process, right? But I'd go down there to do the laundry, and I'd go, hey, Sarge, guess who's in charge now, Sarge, you know? And every so often, I'd pick up that box and just shake the crap out of it. Glare, how do you like that, Sarge? You know, it was just whatever. And it's a process. You know, my youngest sister finally came and rescued my dad from me, And my dad would always say, when I die, you know, in his drunken ballyhoo stuff, he'd always say, when I die, I want you girls to bury my ashes, you know, in the base of a tree so my grandsons, you know, can play on the branches. And true to form, all of us girls had boys because my dad always gets his way anyway. But you know, my sister did that, and like 2 weeks later, this tree is dead as a doornail, okay? Dead. So my sister, you know, did her best to dig my dad back up and put him back in the box, and... And then I guess, you know, a few years later, husband number two or whatever didn't know anything about it, and he just found a box of dirt under the bed and took it to the dump. So, I know, but what are you going to do? You know, but that's only fun here. It's only funny here. Do not tell this story at work. People will not have lunch with you for a very, very, very long time. So you got to know who you're talking to here. So, but anyway... When I was 17, I met my husband, and I should have known there was something wrong with him because my dad liked him right away. And that had, like, never, ever happened. And you got to know, you know, when I say, you know, I grew up in this military house. I grew up in a military house. You know, my dad had a lot of rules and regulations. And we'd bring home these little weenie boys to meet because that's the rules. You got to bring them home, and they have to, you know, before anything could happen. And they, you know, we'd bring in these little weenie boys, and there'd be my dad was over 6 foot tall. He had one eyebrow he could raise like 6 inches off of his forehead. He had jet black hair. You know, he's like Satan himself standing there. And he would drill these little weenie guys about where we're going, what time we had to be back, and then he would tell them what part of their anatomy he was going to remove if we weren't returned in the virginal condition of which we left the house. So it was really hard to get a second date in my house. It just like never, ever happened. And I know that may sound intimidating, but the fact that my dad always had a hand grenade in his hand or a gun never helped the situation either. So that may sound bizarre to some people, but if you grew up in an alcoholic house like I do, that's just run-of-the-mill stuff. That's just what goes on. My dad was always going to blow up the neighbors or the Helms Bakery guy or the mailman or whoever it was that pissed him off that day. You know, and this is where, again, you know, when I refer back to the literature where it talks about how we become sick too, you know, and it's because I know growing up in this, I know it's not right. But this is the house I live in, so I got to rationalize and justify that this behavior is acceptable. You know, and this is, I think, you know, one of the things that makes it really difficult for the family members is when you accept unacceptable behavior, when you start reasoning and trying to make sense out of behavior that you shouldn't be trying to make sense out of. And then this is my distorted thing about, is this a problem or isn't this a problem? But I got to rationalize and justify it because I live here. He's my dad. And as mean as he is and the things he does, it's still my duty to defend him. You know, so when the neighbors tell me about my dad being the drunk or my dad shooting dogs, which he did constantly because he was always saying they had rabies and stuff. So we refused to have pets in our house anymore. You know, when you get enough pets shot from underneath you, it's just like, and then it turns out to be your fault because you didn't do this and you didn't do that. It's just the craziness that goes on in this house. But anyway, like I say, I met Butch, and I should have known he was alcoholic right out of the gate, boy. I mean, he has all kinds of things going on there. You know, I was 17 years old. He was 24, had been married once before. Back living with his mom and dad. No underwear, another clue they're an alcoholic. I think it should be in the Al-Anon literature. It's not, but I keep saying put it in there, people. Any hints you can give would be helpful. But anyway, I went on this date with Butch, and someone had set us up, and we went bowling, and then on the way back from bowling, we were going back to his house with this other couple, and he stopped at a liquor store, and he'd asked me what I would like to drink. Well, I'm a rule and regulation person. I'm Army raised and bred, you know. I follow the rules and regulations. I learned early on, do what the Sarge tells you to do. You keep your nose clean, do all that kind of stuff, stay out of trouble. You know, so he's asking me what I want to drink, so... Well, obviously, he doesn't understand the drinking laws in the state of California, so I proceed to tell him that I am an underage minor, buddy, and it is against the law for me to drink, and I know he heard that day what he continued to hear when he didn't want to hear what I was saying from that point on, as he heard blah, 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 and I know that because he went in and got a gallon of Red Mountain wine, if nothing to impress me with his wine knowledge, because I don't know nothing about drinking, and we go back to this house with this other couple, and we played this game. It's called Pass Out. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of it or not. It's a legitimate game. You can still get it like on eBay. It's a drinking game. It has rules. I love rules. I read all the rules. And, the only way to win this game is to drink. Now, I don't break, you know, I'm a rule person, you know, but there's another rule in my head that's much more supreme of anything else, and that's I must win every game I play. I mean, it's just like, you know, I'm in the Army. You do not surrender. You will be victorious. You can cheat. You can do whatever you need to do. That's how I've been raised. You will be, you know, you don't come in first, you don't come home. It's just, you know, just how I was raised. And so now I have to, so I drink a half a glass of this god-awful wine. I won the game. That's what that was all about. And guess who's so drunk at this point? Guess who drank all the rest of the wine? Now, I want you to know at 17 years old, you know, I know by now that drinking is a problem in our house. I know my dad's a drunk. You can cut the hate between my mom and my dad with a knife. And I can't wait to get the hell out of there. I mean, I've got this big plan, you know, and number one is I'm going to marry somebody because I don't know any else way out. They just got to marry somebody, you know, but I tell you what I know right after marry somebody, I'm going to marry somebody I love. I'm going to marry somebody who loves me. I'm going to marry somebody who only wants girl children. We're going to have a boatload of them, you know, and I'm going to marry somebody who doesn't drink because I know drinking is the thing in our house and that's not going to happen, you know, and here I'm out with this guy, and he's obviously really drunk. You know, boy, that's one of the big things on my list, no drinking. How am I going to work my way around this? And I'll tell you what I remember from that day to this, is that even though that he was really drunk, I'll tell you what I remember is what a good time I had. Fun guy. Just so fun. Made me laugh so much that I'd pee my pants. I was just having the best time of my life. I never had so much fun. You know, and again, in my own defense, up until this point, I'm 17, I'm only going out with other straight-A students. My idea of a hot date is freaking doing a science project or something. I don't know nothing, you know, and now I'm out with Butch, and he's a hippie, you know, long hair, beard, tattoos, the whole nine yards, and I'm having the time of my life, just the absolute time of my life. And then the next question is, how can I go out with this guy again? You know, but because he's drinking, it's on my list. You know, and this is where I will stand toe-to-toe with any alcoholic when it comes to rationalization and justification. You know, when you want to do what you want to do, you will find a way to think your way around it and make it happen. You know, and so I just thought stuff up, which is the story of my life. Because, you know, when you grow up in an alcoholic home, you're not allowed to ask questions. You just, doesn't work. You know, you get slapped, you get shoved, you get told to shut up, but I'm a person that likes information. You know, and when I don't get enough information, then I just make stuff up. You know, I just make my best guess about what I think is going on, and then I make my best guess from there. My sponsor, Jeannie, used to tell me it was information from nowhere. Larsine, who told you that? Nobody. I thought it up all by myself. And she would say, that's information from nowhere. It's floating up in the universe, lands in your head, and becomes fact for you when you act upon it. And I still do it to this day. I can't help it. And, you know, but that day again, I was thinking, how can I go out with this guy again? Thought it up, landed in my head, became fact for me. See, when my dad's drinking, He wants to hit you and yell at you and make you feel bad about who you are. When my husband's drinking, he just wants to kiss you and hug you and tell you how pretty you are. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I can work with that, okay? Because that has the potential that only we can see in you. And, you know, and from that point, you know, I pretty much started dating Butch exclusively. It wasn't easy for me to do that, basically because he couldn't remember my name. But you can't let a little thing like that stop you from going out with an alcoholic. Now, can you? That should be the hardest part, right? And I always like to tell the name story because it's another healing thing with my dad. And so I know my name is different, and it's weird, and it is. And I've never met another Larsine. And the deal is, the day I was born, my name was supposed to be Lawrence Edmund Wells Jr. There was no girl name picked out. I'm supposed to be a boy. And the way my dad would tell me the story is how the night I was born broke his heart. Just broke his heart. My dad left for 2 days. That's how pissed he was at my mom. But he said, you know, but you were first born. You know, you are my firstborn child. So he said, I named you Larsine because it's the name of a town in Scotland. And you should always be proud of that. And if you know my dad, to know how proud my dad was, he was of his Scottish heritage. He just was extremely proud of that. And he always told me I should always be proud of it. Couldn't name me after him. Big disappointment. But your name is Larsine. It's the name of a town in Scotland. Be proud of it. And I am. I've been taught that since I'm tiny. So I've always been proud of it. Fast forward, I've done the whole forgiveness exercise with my dad. I'm in Al-Anon for a while. My dad's died, you know, so I get curious about Larsine, Scotland, and this is before Google and computers. You wanted information, you went to buildings called libraries to go get it. And so I go to the library to look up Larsine, Scotland, and we just have a little weenie library, you know, so, but I couldn't find anything on it. And so I went to the reference librarian. And I ask her, you know, can you find out about Larsine, Scotland for me? And she goes, what do you know? Name of a town in Scotland, that's all I got. And so she said, okay, come back in a couple of weeks, we'll see what we have. And I remember walking in that library 2 weeks later after they called me, and there's a manila envelope, and I pull out one piece of paper, one line across it, no such place as Larsine, Scotland. I am pissed off, you know. You, Al-Anon sucked me in again, made me forgive my dad. You know, here he is stabbing me from the grave, a bunch of BS crapola, because that's all I know how to do. I am hardwired to just get angry. Just get angry. And the reality is that I'm hurt. But I'd much rather you see me pissed off than see me hurt. So that's all I know. And then, you know, so I mean, and I am really hurt, and I'm, you know, but I'm not showing that. I am just really angry. It's going over the whole community, okay? And so we have, our friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's this one guy that goes golfing every year, you know, to Scotland, and he says, Larsine, let me go to Scotland. Maybe there was Larsine, Scotland, like hundreds or thousands of years ago before you lose your stuff, you know. And so he goes off to Scotland. He comes back 2 weeks later from Scotland. No one in Scotland has ever heard of Larsine, Scotland, you know. So now I am going to change my name. Bite me, Dad. I am that pissed off. So I happened to be at this big AA speaker night one Saturday night, and this friend of ours in AA walks up to me, and he goes, Larsine, you're not going to believe this, but I found out that Larsine is a Scottish word. I'm like, you're kidding me. He goes, no, it is Scottish, for father was drunk when daughter was born, so daughter got a weird name. And now, I know the moment that he told me that it wasn't true. I am not that friggin' blonde, okay? I knew it right away. But what he went on to say to me is, you know what, Larsine, I'm alcoholic like your dad's alcoholic. He goes, and I don't know if he's drunk. I don't know if he spelt it wrong, read it wrong. I don't know what happened that night. He goes, but I am here to tell you for a fact that I believe your dad believed that when he named you Larsine, it was the name of a town in Scotland. And just because it's not wrapped the way that you want it to be wrapped doesn't make it any less of a gift. You know, and it's not like I bought that hook, line, and sinker. I absolutely positively did not, but I went home and I thought about it, and I prayed about it. And there's no way that I'm ever going to believe that my dad was that vicious and that mean and that angry that he would make up a name just so it could hurt me. 10 years, 15, 20 years down the line, whatever, I don't. You know, I just don't. And so now I have Larsine. It's on my license plate. It's 7 letters. It fits there perfectly. And I would like to just put a little aside, if you're having trouble with your anger driving, put your name on your license plate. It'll make you behave better, because they'll go like, who flipped me off? Oh, Larsine flipped me off. It's right there on the car, you know? So, I mean, you know, when you have to take accountability, it does make a big difference. But anyway, I have Larsine on my license plates, and a few years back, my husband got me license plate holders that say it's the name of a town in Scotland. So far, I have had 2 total strangers walk up to me and tell me they have been there. Okay, so you cannot make this stuff up, people. You just cannot make this stuff up. But Anyway, Butch and I dated for a couple of years, and I want you to know that my husband was always very upfront about who he was, that he drank a lot, and that he did a lot of drugs. Never hid it from me, never pretended that he didn't. That was always his, you know, he was just always, this is who I am. And yet when I walked into Al-Anon, if you would have said, Larsine, did you know your husband was drinking and doing all the drugs that he was doing, I absolutely positively would have denied it. Because the family disease of alcoholism is all about lying. It's all about trying to make somebody look good, somebody make look bad. It's never about the truth. And, and I would have absolutely denied it. So anyway, after a couple of years of dating Butch, I ended up getting pregnant. I don't care if it's a big deal for you or not. You know, in 1974, it was a big deal for me. And then later on, when our life got really bad behind my husband's drinking and using, I thought it was because God was punishing me because I'd broken the big rule and the big regulation. And that used to be kind of my, God was punishing me thing. And I was in an Al-Anon meeting one day, and my friend Crazy Jean said, you know, Larsine, if you're going to screw around and not use any birth control, you might just get pregnant. You know, just a fact of life. But if you want to blame God for every, you know, bad thing that happens to you, and that's the God that you have, then you might want to reexamine that. You know, and I'm so grateful, you know, that people have always been willing to tell me the truth here, you know, because a lot of days it seems like, you know, people let everybody run around with their feelings and all this other kind of stuff. And, you know, and you got to feel what you got to feel, but it's the truth that'll set you free. And sometimes you can't see it until people point it out to you. But anyway, we ended up getting married a couple of months after my son was born. So if you ask me if I was pregnant when I got married, no, I was not, and I wasn't. And up until that point, I'd never talked to Butch about his drinking or his drug use. But that night, I sat him in the kitchen chair, and I told him the regulations, you know, and how this marriage was going to go down. And I said, you know, once a month, we'll get a babysitter, and you can party. But other than that, you're working, you're bringing home a paycheck, and that's how it's going down. Do you understand? I remember his head doing this, which I took as affirmative. You know, and what I know today is he was just drunk and loaded. His head was just doing this thing, you know. And I know this because day three of our marriage, guess who does not come home all night long? This is a huge violation of the rules and regulations that I have set down, you know. I mean, I just was like absolute, you know, my husband says that I talk as fast as I do because I only had so much time from when he came home to when he passed out for me to tell him everything it was that I had to tell him, because by God, he was going to hear it. He was going to hear it. Now, I want you to know that positively the driving force behind Butch and I getting married was the fact that we had this child. There's no doubt about that. But I want you to know that Butch and I got married in a church. We got married in front of a minister. And we were as sincere as any two people are, that we wanted to love each other and cherish each other. You know, but what he didn't know and I didn't know that day was, it wasn't just he and I that got married, it was also the family disease of alcoholism. And I am here to tell you the family disease of alcoholism doesn't honor any vows, doesn't care about the love or the promises or any of that. It means to tear your family apart. It'll do so through the alcoholic, but I am here to tell you it'll equally do so through the non-drinking member of the family, how I am affected by the disease of alcoholism. You know, just one drunk story, and I got a call from Butch's friends, whom I affectionately refer to as scum of the earth people, and these were the drug dealers and stuff, and Butch was over at their house, and he was so drunk and so loaded that if I did not come and get him, they, the drug dealers, were going to call the police, okay, because this is just the shape he's in. And so I remember putting on my cape, and off I go to get him, and... And I remember him, you know, I got there and he's in the drug dealer's bushes, you know. I mean, they just kicked him out of the house. He's right on their bushes and the drug dealers are looking out the Venetian blinds, you know, to make sure I'm there to get him. And our son was just a baby. And anyway, I got him in the car and drove home, and I went to take our infant son to go put him in his crib. And I come to get Butch, and Butch has gotten out of the car. He's fallen in the street. He's cracked his head on the asphalt. He's, you know, he's got a head wound. He's bleeding. I'd like to tell you I'm concerned about him. I am not. I just don't want anybody seeing him, you know, in this condition. But he's 180 pounds of wet washcloth. There's no picking him up, you know. So I grab him by the ankles and I heave him up over the curb, and I'm dragging him down by the ankles down the sidewalk. Little trickle of blood like a snail trail kind of following right behind there, you know. And why we call these people normies, I have not a clue. I don't know why. But I'm dragging a guy bleeding by the head down the sidewalk, and this guy stops the car and says, "Are you having a problem?" And I'm like, "Yes, my husband's fallen and he can't get up." And so the guy helps me get him up, and now, you know, I, and for whatever reason, again, I'm just a very, it's the military thing. I got to make a list of, you know, every emergency, list, you know, and our bedroom's upstairs, so not only do I have to get him in the house, I have to get him up a flight of stairs and into the bed, because that's where a head injury person goes. And once that information lands in my head, we are doing it, people. And so anyway, so now this guy and I are going up the stairs with Butch, and now the words are flying between him and I. We are screaming at each other, and Mr. Good Samaritan no longer wishes to participate, okay? He is like, I am out of here, you know? So he dumped Butch on the bed, and he was out the door like a flash. And now, you know, I want my husband to die desperately. I just do. I'm just so tired of all this crap. You know, when someone said, why didn't you divorce him and let him win? No. That's not how it goes down. He goes out feet first. I'm a widow. You'll feel sorry for me. That's a win-win situation right there, people. And, you know, but I don't, you know, but now there's a big puddle of blood on the bed now, and I want him to die, but I'm the only one there, and my fingerprints are all over everything, so that's not going to go down. So I call 911 because I am hysterical, and they send hook and ladder truck, fire department, police, everybody's there, and I'm in the bedroom with the baby, and I'm crying, whoa, my husband. And the police come in, and they go, Mrs. Gantner, your husband says he injured himself because you pushed him down a flight of stairs. Now, of course, I hadn't done that. You know, and in this situation, there's a lot going on here. I have an infant child. You know, they could take my child away from me. All this stuff could happen. But I'll tell you what happened to me when they said that to me. Red hot, pissed off, mad. That's just where I go. There's no logic. There's no reason. And I'm the sober person here. I told those police I didn't do that, but if you'll prop him up in front of the police department, I'll be happy to push him down in front of all of you, you know. And they reassured me that they wouldn't have to do that. They clean Butch up. He's got this little weenie cut, just needs a few stitches, you know, but he's too drunk to walk, you know, so he's got to go by ambulance to the hospital. And, you know, I don't care what day or what time it is, when you got a hook and ladder truck outside your house, everybody's there. And my husband is a friendly guy. He knows all the neighbors he always has. He comes out on the gurney, hey, you Frank, hey, you Joe, you know, they're all out there, you know, and there, Butch, what happened? Larsine pushed me down a flight of stairs. And of course, every single one of them believes them because all they ever see is easygoing Butch and screaming Banshee Larsine. You know, that's just how it turns out. You know, and somewhere in all that insanity, I went to an Al-Anon meeting. I had a friend, you know, she'd gone to school, her dad, you know, her mom was an alcoholic, her dad went to Al-Anon. So I called him up, he took me to this meeting, great literature, but not the piece I want, which is how to get him to stop drinking and do what you want him to do, because that's all I am interested in. Yet when I'm sitting in that front row, Larsine, do you want your life to be different? Oh my God, do I want my life to be different? Larsine, what are you willing to do about it? Nothing, because it's not my fault. You fix him. You fix him, I'll be okay. That's my deal, you know, and that was my Al-Anon career at that point. And, you know, and then just back into the insanity and back into the craziness. And on this one particular day, we were going to have a family reunion. His family reunion, he's one of nine kids. I'm only alcoholic, lucky me, out of the whole bunch. And I make him raise his right hand and promise me that he'll be sober that day. And he does, because he means to be. You know, every time he's promised me, and I know every time he did, he meant it. Every time he did, he meant it. And, you know, and that's one thing I want to say, too, because I've probably been to, I don't know, thousands of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings by now. And I've never one time ever heard an alcoholic get up to the podium or share at a meeting that he drank because he wanted to hurt his family. Ever. Not one time. But it feels like that when you're on the other side of it. Feels like they're doing it to you because it looks like they're doing it to you. And that's the family disease of alcoholism because that's what it wants it to think. When all of a sudden, people who love each other become mortal enemies. What the heck is that all about? But anyway, he promised me he'd be sober that day. And the day comes, and guess who's so drunk and loaded he can't even stand up? And I am pissed off because that's all I know how to do. And I'm here to tell you, no matter how drunk or blacked out or whatever my husband's been, he's never, ever raised a hand to hit me because he's not that guy. He just doesn't do that. But that day, I was poking him in the chest, and I was egging him to hit me. Let's just take it to the next level. You know, and then all of a sudden, you know, I became very conscious. By now, we have two little boys, you know, they're toddlers, and they're each pulling on my pant legs, and I look down, and the big tears coming down their little faces. Mommy, mommy, please stop yelling at daddy. And I would like to tell you that I had a moment of clarity then, but I did not. What did I do? I started screaming at those little boys. How dare they tell me to stop yelling at their dad when their dad's the reason our life is the piece of crap that it is, blah, blah, blah. And by the time I get done screaming at these little boys, I watch my drunken husband walk out the front door, and I, the sober mom, say to the drunken father, where do you think you're going? And the drunken dad turns to me and says, I'm leaving because we're upsetting the kids. And I don't tell you this story because I'm proud of it. I tell you this story because I think I'm the good guy. I'm the one with the job. I'm the one with the roof over our head. You know, I don't even realize how I'm being affected by the disease of alcoholism. No idea. You know, I think I'm protecting my children. They didn't need protection from their dad. They needed protection from their mother, their sober mother, their screaming, ranting, raving sober mother. You know, they were always good with their dad. I mean, he passed out a lot. He was a blackout guy all the time. And they build Tinker Toy bridges over him, tie Tonka trucks to him, pretend he was Gulliver. You know, I mean, you know, but I was the crazy one. I was the absolute insane one and didn't even know it. And, you know, and then, you know, to cut to the chase, I don't know, it was a year or two after that, Butch got arrested for drunk driving, which was no big deal in the 70s. You paid a lawyer $500, it got reduced to reckless, and you're off on your merry way again. He did that lots of times. But this particular time, something happened for him. And he ended up getting sober behind that drunk. And I remember he went into this hospital program, and they had to detox him because he's a big Valium guy, big. I mean, he'd take 30, 40 Valium a day. So they detox him from his Valium. And I remember I was leaving him in the psychiatric unit. I got to the door and he called me back, you know, and I thought because he changed his mind, he didn't want to stay. Instead, he reached into his pocket and he handed me the Valium he'd brought in case of emergency. And he'd never parted with a Valium in his life, so I knew something was different. And I went home and I took it because I was a flaming basket case, so... And I think I slept for like 36 hours on one 10 milligram Valium. But in my own defense, I was pretty tired. You know, if it was up to me, he'd still be in the psychiatric ward because I love it. They lock him up for you. They watch him for you. I think it's a great setup. But they ended up introducing him to the alcoholism treatment side of that program. He ended up getting sober there. And I am really pleased to let you know, he stayed sober the whole time. He had 44 years of sobriety a week before he died. And I always get weepy at this point, and it's not because of that. I always get weepy at this point because, first of all, I'm grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous because you saved the life of a really good man. But I always get weepy at that point because I want you to think if my dream had come true and my husband had died like I wanted him to, I want you to think about that really angry woman and those two little kids, and I want you to think 44 years later what kind of a family you think we would be today. That's why it's really important for people in Alcoholics Anonymous to reach out to the family members. You know, you don't know. You just don't know. So anyway, Butch got into AA, and I'm sorry, but you know how you guys are when you're sober. Jeez. You know, it's like, you know, you're 30 days sober. Give me the checkbook. You know, it's like, nah, that ain't happening. You know, it just was craziness. You know, and back when my husband got sober, they didn't do any family recovery. They said I should go to Al-Anon. I did. You know, I'd already been. I told you it didn't work, you know, but they said I had to go to at least one meeting. So I went back to that meeting. I raised my hand, new person. I was here about a year and a half ago. I asked you how to get my husband sober, and you didn't tell me, and I'm not going to tell you how I got him sober now because I was sure it was something I had done. And you know what they said to me at that meeting? They said, keep coming back. You are absolutely right. Because I am here to tell you, whether you're at an AA meeting or an Al-Anon meeting, when you share and they tell you to keep coming back, it's because you said the most asinine BS crapola in the universe. You got to keep coming back until your head finally pops out of your ass. You know, that's just how that goes down. But I did not know that, you know. And I thought, game over, Butch is sober, I win. And so I wasn't doing anything. And then what ended up happening, you know, is... I would go to in the beginning to him, I went to a lot of AA meetings, made sure he heard the stuff he's supposed to hear, you know, and all of that. I didn't really like going to AA meetings because I was freaked out you would think I was an alcoholic. It just freaked me out. I don't know why. Again, information. And so one time I tell him, I said, how are they going to know I'm not an alcoholic? And he said to me, don't worry, they'll know. I thought that was complimentary. Apparently it is not, just so you know, But Butch, he just went to his Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and he did the best thing in the world, as far as I'm concerned, going to AA, you know. He brought his program home. He just brought it home. And I'm always going to be super, super grateful for him for doing that. What ended up happening is, you know, I didn't need Al-Anon, it was him. But 2 years into my husband's sobriety, I found myself as angry as I've ever been in my whole life. Pissed off. Just pissed off. You know, because I was always sure when Butch was sober, that would fix me. When Butch was a good husband, a good father, a good provider, all those things would fix me. And 2 years into his sobriety, he was beyond anything that I thought could happen, you know. But I was as angry as I've ever been. It's like my friend Crazy Gene says, it's like they get sober and you're out of a job. You know, I mean, I just didn't know where to go with it. But anyway, one day I'm very task-oriented. The rule in my house is there is no fun till the chores are done. That's a military thing. And so one day I'm doing laundry because I'm very focused, you know, and now the boys are big. They're in the living room with their dad. They're laughing. They're cutting up. I can hear them. I walk in the living room with my laundry basket and dead silence. Because that's my gift to this family. I suck the joy right out of the room. I just do. And I'm walking through that room, and I heard God's voice in my head as clear as a bell. And what God said to me is, Larsine, you become your dad. And even though I was an alcoholic like my dad, boy, I was trying to rule that family with an iron fist, so afraid they'll slip through my fingers. Just nothing they could do was good enough. Just blah, 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 just battering, battering, battering. And I don't think God gives you that kind of an answer that he doesn't give you a solution, because the next thing I heard is, this is who you are supposed to be, and I knew it wasn't. You know, and so that's when I started going to Al-Anon, not to keep an alcoholic sober. He's almost 2 years sober at this point, you know, not to get him sober. I came because I was sick and tired of being sick and tired, and I got my first sponsor, Jeannie, and I remember the first time I used her as a sponsor, Butch had a dead battery, and he asked me to jump it, and I did. Then he ran out of gas, which pissed him off. So he got angry and he started yelling. So I started yelling right back at him. He went off to work. I went upstairs, called my sponsor, and reported his behavior. Because that's what I do. And I remember telling her, and when I got done telling her, she told me I owed him an amends. Like, whoa, whoa, whoa. First of all, Jeannie's not from America, so she doesn't know how we do things in America, you know. And then she missed the who started it, which I think is so important, so I started telling her the story a second time. She stopped me cold. She said, don't, I heard you the first time. And she says, and another thing, don't you ever dare call me again and start a conversation with what Butch did or didn't do. I don't care. I'm not Butch's sponsor. I am Larsine's sponsor. And for what she did and what she said, it was unkind and unnecessary. You took a bad situation and you made it worse. And for that, you owe your husband an amends. She hung up on me. Click, end of conversation. You know, I learned valuable lessons. Never call your sponsor first thing in the morning. You got all day long to think about what she told you to do. You know, and then I have to do it because I'm a rule follower. You know, and I'm not a procrastinator by any stretch of the imagination. I don't know. Butch walked in the door that night. I marched right up to him, and I said, I'm sorry I let your shitty attitude affect me the way that it did. And I'll try and do better in the future. Now, I know that that is not probably the best amends you've ever heard. But I am here to tell you that I don't know that I've ever made a better amends in my life, because that was the first time I was this much willing to take direction from someone who wanted me to have a life that was happy, joyous, and free, and was showing me how that path looks like. It's not about who's right. It's nothing to do with that. It's about love. It's about taking care of other people sometimes when they're, you know, they have a right to be angry, and I don't have to fix it or jump into it or do anything else. So what do I want my life to look like? What do I want my kids' lives to look like? You know, and that's kind of just been the journey that's been, you know, going on and going on. You know, just real quick, you know, both my boys had trouble with drugs and alcohol, but the youngest one was the worst. And when he was 12 years old, I come home from a meeting. My husband told me he had dropped acid. He's 12 freaking years old. I mean, I'm like out of my mind, but my husband's like, relax, relax. I gave him some milk and he's listening to Mozart, which I guess is what you're supposed to do. I don't think that's the answer, but according to my husband, it is, and he is the expert. And so, you know, but of course I wasn't going to do that, so I stayed up all night with this kid. And I guess when you're on your very first acid trip and your mom is in your face all night long, it's not very fun. Apparently, my head was a giant balloon going back and forth and all this other kind of stuff. So anyway, he never did acid again, so yay. But he did a lot of other stuff, and I tell you, it got to be a real heartbreaker, and I don't have time to go into all of that right now, but it got to the point that we had to ask our son to leave our home, and, you know, and I'm not a big fan about Black Belt Al-Anon, because I don't know any mom that's had to ask their child to leave their house that feels like a Black Belt Al-Anon. You know, and I remember one time going to my sponsor's house and saying, you know, how am I supposed to be happy, joyous, and free when I have a child who could die from this disease? And I'll never forget what she said to me, because it changed my life forever. Because she says, Larsine, if you're not happy, joyous, and free, then you give that kid no hope. And that is absolutely your responsibility. But unacceptable behavior is unacceptable behavior. But you have to love that kid where he's at. And in Al-Anon, we practice something called unconditional love. And so she made me look up unconditional in the dictionary. And you know what it says? No conditions. So it's kind of clear. And that's just how I learned to love my kid, because there's nothing he could do that could make me not love him but unacceptable behavior, and he was stealing from us. And our house was a sober house, and it wasn't when he was doing the things that he was doing. You know, and I mean, and, you know, and this kid grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous. He was 3 years old when his dad got sober. You know, and I don't, and again, no one ever said this to me, but in my mind I heard, you do what you're supposed to do here. You work this great program and nothing bad will ever happen to you. It's BS. You know, it's just, it's, he had a path that he had to go on. You know, and so I got to learn to love that kid unconditionally. And then one day came, I had to tell him he couldn't come in, you know, he couldn't come over if he was loaded because I couldn't take it. It was so painful for me to see. And I remember one Thanksgiving he came over, he stayed for all of 10 minutes. That's all that he could do. All that he could do was those 10 minutes. But what I got to say is after 10 minutes and he said, Mom, I got to go. I just got to hug him and say, thank you for coming. Thank you for sharing part of Thanksgiving with me. I love you very much. You know we're here for you. And he had to do the path that he had to. And like I say, I don't have a lot of time to go into all of that stuff that happened with him. But I'll tell you that at 36 years old, he turned himself into Alcoholics Anonymous. He had 9 years sober last August, of which I am truly, truly grateful. You know, and he's living a good life. And, you know, and when he turned himself into AA, he went to this big speaker meeting this one particular night. It's a speaker meeting that my husband and I always go to, and we were out of town, which is why he went. And... But he said he got to the doors, and he knew so many people. I mean, we've been in the program a long time. He knows the community. They know him. And he said it freaked him out because he saw so many people that he knew. And so he started walking away, just had to leave. And he says as he got to the parking lot, there was this older lady there, and she was walking in, and she asked him if this is where the AA meeting was. And he goes, yeah, it's right there. And she goes, well, I'm visiting from out of town. My sister, I have to go home tomorrow, and I wanted to catch an AA meeting. He goes, well, it's right there. Go ahead. And he started to walk away, and he says, and then she put out her arm and said, will you take me in? You know, and I just share this story with you because I want you to know, you can't help your own kid, but I'm here to tell you, you know, it's easy to say why some people get sober, why some people don't. You know, I don't think there's anything in the cosmos about any of that. You know, we talk about, you know, but for the grace of God, I think it's but for the acceptance of God's grace. Because I think at the moment that you have God's grace, that you accept that in your life, that God will put somebody out there with an arm, and you just have it's your turn to take it or not take it. And when Earl had that moment of grace, God put that person in his life to walk him into a meeting full of people he already knew, but it took a stranger to take him in. God's a real powerful thing, absolutely unbelievable. You know, just before my husband died, we knew he was really sick. He had cancer. And a couple weeks before, he was acting up, being a butthead. And so I said something to him about it. And then he said to me, are those the last words you want to say to me before I die? And I said, well, they will be if you keep being a butthead. And I share this story with you because I want you to know, because of the program, my husband and I were very, very current. And we were always in the moment, always in the, you know, what was going on right here, right now. And that's what if there's any message I want you to know, it's just that right here, right now is all that matters. All this other BS and crapola, you know, just put it aside. It's not important. You know, and now I have a phone and I have all these memories that keep popping up, all these pictures of Butch all the time and stuff. And I told my friend the other day, boy, I'm really glad I never took pictures of us fighting. And, you know, it's been a really, really difficult road for me and I miss him a lot. But God is really powerful here, and I had to take care of my son's cat, who's a freaking prima donna, for 3 weeks a little while ago, and this cat's just, like, so spooky, just a freaky cat. And so this one, so I'm always telling this cat, knock it off, you're fine, you know? I mean, you got a roof over your head. I'm here to take care of you. People love you. You know, and about 2 weeks into that, you know, all of a sudden it became very clear to me that that's how God was talking to me. He was telling me what I was telling the cat, Larsine, you're okay. I'm here to take care of you. There's people that love you. It'll be all right if you let it be all right. Be good to yourself. Thank you for having me.